But when you went to the UWF in 1987, were you under the impression that it was going to be a long-term thing? Because the UWF kind of folded not long after you had joined. You were pushed.
I had never thought, Bill Watts, the way Bill Watts and my dad ran things wonderfully. The UWF was actually beating Vince McMahon in the ratings in several of their markets.
Yeah.
In their television markets, they were beating them by 2 or 3 points in some markets. And I always thought that the UWF, I mean, that was a mainstay. It was sort of like Texas, with the Sportatorium, with Bill Watts and the UWF. It was such a class promotion. It was hard to work for. And when I went there, yeah, I didn't think that it would ever fold. And then Jim Crockett came in with $6 million and bought the territory. That's what we heard. I'm not sure if that was the actual figure or not.
Do you think that Watts maybe made a mistake trying to go national and compete with Vince? Like, do you think that, like, some
no,
of the...
No, I think he did a good job.
Yeah.
I really do. I think what it was, I do think what they should have done was maybe... if he would have stayed by himself, he would have, it would have been 3 companies.
Mm-hmm.
He figured, he'd sell out to Crockett while the money was on the table and then Crockett would battle. But he also thought that his territory would be kept intact.
Yeah.
When Crockett bought it out, he came in there and basically he tore the house that Watts built down instead of putting it over and relishing in the fact that, hey, we have acquired, and making it something, making it a goal for the fans of look how great this is. The NWA is now, taken over and we've merged with the UWF. And we're bringing wrestling back to
it. Yeah, Watts had such a great roster in the UWF as well, and it feels like they could have taken advantage of that more than they did. And obviously, not everyone was brought in to Crockett, and you were one of the guys who wasn't, unfortunately, brought in. So,
well, see, okay, yeah, the reason I wasn't brought in was before. Okay, whenever Nicola Baby Doll and I got married,
yeah.
I guess that we committed political suicide. The office didn't want that. That went away against everything their wishes. But hey, we were 2 young people in this business and we were in love.
Yeah.
I still love her with all my heart. And she will always be my perfect 10. I love her to death. I just can't live with her.
So as a young, good-looking baby face as well, were you told by the promoters as well to maintain the single? Basically pretend that you were single so the girls would come and,
Right. And that's what it was. But with Nicola on the road with me and everything, I could always, scoot off and nobody knew about it. I wasn't carrying a girl with me everywhere I went or anything like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, when we got married, oh gosh, that was political suicide. So what Jim Crockett did was to punish us. He sent us out to Kansas City. They were going to split us up. They were going to leave her in Charlotte and me in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, we're not going to be married every other Thursday night.
Yeah.
And so she came out to Kansas City with me. Now, she was on the heel side. I was on the baby face side. So Big Boss Man or Bubba Rogers, Raid Trailer.
Yeah.
Had only had a couple of matches. Warlord had only had a couple of matches. So they all send us out to Kansas City. I was the new Central States champion. Every once in a while, I would get the treat of being able to work with Buddy Landell or Bill Dundee or somebody like that. But usually every night it was me and Ray Trailer or me or Warlord or me and Bulldog Bob Brown.
That's awesome. I'm such a fan of.
That's why I wanted to tell you the matches with me and Boss Man.
Yeah.
In WWE or WWF, you know, those are really good matches. You know, and I saw that Vince is pulling everything off of YouTube. They were really awesome matches.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, I had taught, basically I taught Warlord and Bubba both how to work in the Kansas City territory.
Wow. So I'm guessing that Bossman was. You were really one of Bossman's first opponents in the WWF as well.
Yes. And God, we worked so well together in Kansas City in front of 11 people.
Yeah.
And then when you're out in front of 17,000, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm really hoping some of that stuff shows up on the network as well, because they seem to be finally, you know, really digging the archive sort of thing. And you know, what do you think of the network in particular?
I don't have it. I've seen it, you know, here and there. I'd like to get it later on, whenever I get settled. Yeah, they've got 5 pages on me on there. My buddy was showing me the other day. He said, "Man," he goes, "you're on 5 pages of the network."
Yeah.
You know, and you know, of course, a lot of it is WCW. I mean, WCW or NWA. Mm-hmm. You know, because they got that out when they got Turner. But, you know, it's really neat, you know. And what's happening is now people, like I was down in Florida last May, and I wrestled 6 times on Earth Day birthday.
Uh-huh.
It was a big event at the college. There were 11 bands playing, and we wrestled every time the bands switched. So there were 6 breaks, and there were 11,500 people. Well, the guy told me, he said, "You can do whatever you want to." So I went out there and I wrestled 6 times that day. I was the only guy undefeated. The first match was the singles. Then I did a handicap match. And then I did a 6-man tag match, but one partner was hurt. And the other one, let's just say, wasn't my cup of tea. So I had him watch the guy that was hurt both on the outside, and then I wrestled in the 6-man tag match with no tag team partners. So then I wrestled another time, and then I came back from the ring that time, but after the 4th time, and a guy in the dressing room stood up and prison punched his girlfriend right in the face and dropped her right in the dressing room.
Oh, wow.
Or in the tent, and ran to the ring. And there was this little fellow over there jumping all around, like he all excited about going to the ring and try to have his match. He just put his hand off my hand on his chest and said, "You got the night off." And I went out there, and that fellow that I got in the ring with, I did some, you know. Anyway, I'll just put it like this. He hasn't wrestled since, and I chased him out of the fairgrounds, clean out to the parking lot. But I wrestled 6 times that day.
And I'm guessing as well, because you used to have worked, you know, you have worked with just every name you could possibly think of. You know how to have different matches with the right opponent as well. So that, you know, I'm guessing that was just, you know, easy for you to be able to have 6 matches but make them all different. And
you know, nothing is ever the same. I just, you know, pick different things when I go out there.
Yeah.
You know, and it turns out different every time. The reason I'm so I guess agile or versatile when it comes to that, it's because the guys that I, you know, when I broke in the business, when I came in, we had guys like Johnny Weaver, like I said, Paul Jones. We had Sonny Fargo, Rufus Jones, Jimmy the Boogie Woogie Man Valiant. You had all these great main eventers, professionals already, and they would sit there and they would watch your matches.
Yeah.
You know, and then they critique you on the way over. I learned so much being Johnny Weaver's tag team partner. You know?
Yeah.
And this was back when I first broke in. And, you know, and I didn't realize the education I was getting then. But I got to tell you, I am so thankful I got it.
Yeah.
You know? Because you don't get guys today. You don't get the guys I watch in the dressing rooms. you know, when I go and I watch and everybody's off to themselves and nobody's trying to, you know, look out for, you know, for the next guy. They're just looking for a way to stab him in the back and take his spot.
Yeah, as well, you know, like when you're not, you know, from what I've seen, because I can't really claim to know, but when wrestlers don't study other wrestlers' matches on the card as well, if someone does something in the first match that someone plans to do in the main event, you know, that's going to mean nothing but trouble for that guy in the preliminary match as well, because you've got to think to maybe check and make sure that, you know, you don't want to do something in the first match that's going to take away the excitement about the
match. Like I did an event the other night, and two or three guys went to the ring with the same music.
Right, okay.
Well, that's my song. Well, that's my song. And I'm sitting here and I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, man, somebody should give them all like a hand towel and let them swat at each other, because they're swatting at each other and bitching at each other like little girls. It's kind of like, you know, I want to slap them in the head and go, you know, grow a pair and you know, take what's yours,
No, definitely.
But yeah, I mean, people in the first match, and this goes back, you know, the first match there should never even be a punch thrown in the first match. You shouldn't have a whole lot of choking and a whole lot of, you know, stuff like that. That needs to be saved for your main event. You've got a real responsive crowd. Yeah, you give them something, but you give them a little bit.
Yeah.
Let them find it, grab hold of it, and then let them charge forward with it.
I have friends who don't really understand my way of thinking as well, because again, I'm not a wrestler and I can't pretend to know what it takes to be a wrestler as well, but just from a fan point of view, something like WrestleMania that was just shown a month ago, it's a 5-hour long show and every match has every possible move that you could possibly think of, so by the main event for the title,
you've seen everything,
you're tired. And the match at WrestleMania as well, you know, it was getting boring chants and stuff, and that's just an indictment of the booking, really, and just the lack of just thinking.
What's wrong right now? What's wrong right now is if you've got armchair quarterbacks, people that have never been in the ring wrestling, and they're writing up all these. I've seen how they do it now. They script the moves out move for move, and then they give it to this sheet of paper to a Michael Hayes or Arn Anderson or this one, a Dean Malenko, that one or the other one. And then that guy goes and he has to get with this match, because that's his match. He's the producer of that match, and he has to show these guys how to wrestle, because they don't know how to wrestle. Characters are not wrestlers.
I think that, like, you know, there's a lot of amazing athletes as well, but it's just at the same time, there's a lot of overexposure for me. Like, you know, back in the day, the champion was on TV maybe once a month with a match.
Right.
You know, and now when they're on it, and this is just, and I try not to be critical of it as well, because, I mean, you know, we all know that, you know, there's so many critics of wrestling, because it's, in a way, it's an easy thing to have an opinion on, because, you know, everyone watches it, but just from a fan point of view, you just get burned out, really, and that's why I love the older stuff, because it never gets it's older stuff, but it never gets old, if you know what I mean, because it's just
right. My event next, I'm going to Vegas now. I know in Vegas at the CAC convention, I know they're, you know, on Sunday night they're probably going to have like a 5-hour show or a 4-hour show. They, you know, it seems it gets notorious for that. What happens is so many guys are getting in there and trying to buy into a match, and then you got 17 or 18 matches on the card, and everybody's trying to, you know, do this, do that, and everything else short. But by the time it's all said and done, the show's ended up being four and a half hours long. The people are tired after two.
Yeah.
They're wanting to move around after two and a half, and they're walking out at about three.
Yeah.
And that's what happens, you know, and I hate to see it, because the guys that are supposed to be featured, there's nobody there when they get in the ring to do their things, because they've had to sit there and go through every Joe Blow there is, you know, to get to that point. Me and Cahagas, I think it was the second year I was there. Okay, I went and I got in the ring for the battle royal, and he gave me my respect, and he sat there, and we both stood at each other. It was a way to chew up a minute, you know, and I didn't have to blow up. But, you know, I got in the ring slowly and everything, and then the next guy to come out, it was a match kind of like a Royal Rumble.
Yeah.
So the next guy come out there, and he did, when he jumped in the ring, he did some Hong Kong fluey karate stuff. And we did, me and Kagus looked at each other. We both snatched him by the back of the head and tossed him. And then we worked together. And what we did was everybody that we didn't think deserved or needed to be in the ring,
yeah,
they got thrown out. You know, go ahead and let it go now. You know, because I don't want somebody in there that's not properly trained, doesn't know what they're doing. You're in a ring with 20 guys and stuff like that. You're falling down. You're taking bumps or something, trying to do something and be King Kong or however, and you crash somebody's knee in or
yeah,
anything like that can happen. You begin that man's career. You know, I see so many stupid things.
I just, you know, the fact that, you know, I don't want to presume on your age, you know, but like you have wrestled for.
No, I'm 54 years old. Okay. I'm 54.
And you're wrestling, you know, for the APWL show, which is coming on May the 5th. Details will be below the show. But the fact that you're still able to do this at 54, and okay, I'm sure you have hurting joints and everything, but you never did stupid things, you know what I mean? Like, you weren't taking...
Oh, yeah, you should see my bumps. You know, look at my highlight reel. I'm on everybody's highlight reel. My bumps, the bumps I took and everything.
But
you got to remember, man, I was paralyzed twice.
Yeah.
I was paralyzed in 91 for 9 months. Then I got re-injured when the earthquake hit Northridge, California, L.A.
Oh, really? You were there for that?
I was busting doors down. So
wow.
Yeah, I was there for that. This doctor had been working on me when WCW let me go because the surgery was going to cost $27,000 and Nicola had, and I had split. She had left and I didn't have anything. I got my, instead of getting anything of, okay, we're going to try to be with you and stand behind you. No, I got my walking papers. I got fired from the company.
Good grief. Like with the money that WCW...
Huh?
That when you hear about the stories about WCW giving people like 100 grand contracts and not using them, whereas you right. were working hard and injured yourself and they let you go while injured, that's terrible. Like,
right. Well, so they are the two people that signed my papers of dismissal were my father and Magnum TA. Now, Magnum, when he was in the car wreck, I was taking money out of my check every week. You know, all the boys were.
Yeah.
So that they could, you know, they could make it. They'd be able to make it, you know. And we all were. And, you know, but anyway, it was just kind of like when I got hurt and everything, instead of offering me the same thing, anything, you know. But anyway, hey, I walked my way. But yeah. I was paralyzed twice. I've been broke up, hurt up so many different times. I've been broken, I mean, separated shoulders. I've got a fractured sternum. Gosh, I've had my left arm broke, my right wrist fractured, my right ankle fractured. But I'm one of those, okay, what, oh gosh, just fills my heart with pride is I can say I'm one of those Terry Funk tape up and go guys.
Yeah.
You know, I walked in the match when I was young. I was walked into the matches with Nicola and I walked into the matches and Terry Funk was laid out on a table back in the back in Greensboro. So what's wrong? Terry goes, oh, Sam, my hip is fractured, you know, and he laid on that table all the way till it was time to go to the ring. Wow. And then he got up and he went out and did 45 minutes with Flair.
Yeah, Funk is something else. Like, I'm watching, you know, so much of the Funk Lawler Memphis stuff at the moment with the empty arena match mm-hmm. and everything. And Funk is the best legit crazy man I think there's ever been. In
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I worked with Terry. I only worked with Terry one match a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, and I, you know, if he wanted to do something, I would go out there and put him over right in the middle. But he ain't spending to hold me or whatever. Now, a couple of years ago at the CACs, I went to go get a soda or a cup of coffee. And he goes, Sam, I've got something right here you need to put your lips around. It's the best. And I said, I saw him pulling out the mason jar. He had some moonshine, you know, some homemade liquor. And blueberry liquor. He goes, and I said, Terry, I said, I'm really sorry. I said, but I haven't drank in 7 years. I gave drinking up. And he goes, and Sam, that's a good thing. I remember you used to drink a lot. You know? He said, that just means there's more for me. And I was like, Terry, knock it out. Yeah. I love that. Yeah, that guy's the greatest.
Yeah,
you know, I was fortunate enough to be on the road. And I was fortunate enough to be around him when I was growing up and stuff like that. So. You know.
Well, Terry Funk, there's an amazing story that Jim Cornette tells. When Terry Funk was in Smoky Mountain in 94, he did his first moonsault in 1994 in Smoky Mountain.
Yeah.
He must have been like mid-40s at the time. And Jim Cornette was like, what the hell did you do? And he's like, I don't know, Jimmy, but I think I'm going to do it again.
Yeah, I think he was like 48 when he did it, 46, 48, something like that.
But
because he did it in Greensboro not long after that.
Oh, wow. See, but yes, you've had a lot of injuries, but you've never did a 450 splash to the concrete floor on a bed of nails. You know what I mean? You didn't do anything
absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I got to tell you another one. Okay, one night I was sitting up there, and I think I just wrestled Boss Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I hit him with a drop kick off the top. Yeah, I used to do that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided one night I drop kicked him off the top, and I just, while I was laying there, I just decided that hurts. I'm not going to do that no more. So I took that out of my repertoire, you know? So, yeah.
It's smart, and I'm sure I did years to your career as well, you know?
Yeah, it probably did.
No, but the thing
is, you know, I shouldn't, you know, it's kind of like I shouldn't be walking now, but it's like, you know, I got a powerful force in my life, and that's my Lord and Savior. And that's God up above me. And he wakes me up every day. He gives me every day. You know, I should have, every day past, this January 17th in 2010 was a horrible day for me. Actually, it was a horrible day.
Yeah.
And I was going to end it all. You know, and I took my bed sheet, and I slid it up and I braided it together, and I ran it through the bars in the prison on Murderer's Row, and I made the two knots.
Wow.
You know, and I tie knots for offshore, you know, and you got to be in a dark, deep,
yeah,
hurting place in your heart to make this decision, you know. I mean, I wasn't playing, and I put the nooses over my neck, and I said, God, you know, you're the only one that can stop this now. You know, I was hurting real bad, and I wasn't going to spend the rest of my life in a prison like that.
No. The thing is, because I don't know too much about what happened, and if you don't want to go into it, and we'll not.
No, I don't mind at all, because if I can help people, I want to.
Did you really think that you were going to be in prison forever at that point? Or
yes. I had been told. I went to the court to pay an improper lane change. They threw that out and hit me with a fourth offense DWI.
What, right.
Or DUI.
Yeah.
I told the district attorney, I said, I've never had a third offense. And he said, if I have to redo the paperwork, then he was going to hit me with the Habitual Offender Act. You know, that three times you're gone. And he said, Henny, you'll spend the rest of my life. I'll spend the rest of my life in prison. And where they had me was Murderer's Row. They had me on maximum security disciplinary because I was a security threat.
Good.
So you got to think, the worst of the worst of the worst human beings here. I'm in there with them.
Yeah. Did you feel that the judge kind of used you as an example for everyone else, sort of thing?
No. The judge actually wanted me to stay in Senecor.
Mm-hmm.
It was the district attorney that was shoving it down his throat. And my lawyer, check this out, my lawyer, even after I got sentenced, told the district attorney because he didn't know I hadn't been removed from the courtroom yet.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I just gave you 10 years.
Wow.
Meaning my lawyer sold me down the river so he could make somebody else a better deal.
And did he was he aware of your past as a star as well? And did he want to kind of maybe make a name for himself out of that as well? Or
I'm thinking it could be. I just think, you know, I don't know. There's so many factors that it could be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I got to be honest. If I hadn't been in prison, I'd be dead now.
Mm-hmm.
So prison was not, I mean, even though that hard part, yeah, it was bad, but those nooses broke when I jumped, and every day has been a blessing since.
Yeah.
And I value, I mean, I don't know. Well, yeah, I do. I guess I valued the education I got in prison. Because I see things a whole lot differently now. But if I hadn't been locked up, if I'd have been out on my own when I lost my mom and then I lost my dad 5.5 months later,
mm-hmm.
I would have drank myself to death.
Wow.
Because I wouldn't have had the proper tools or the knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't until I went through the program, a 9 month long rehab program through prison, that I learned so much about addiction, about yourself, I've got one deal. It's about the 27 different character traits
mm-hmm.
of an addict, you know, and you can sit there now, you know, all addicts don't have every one,
yeah,
but you can see seven or eight of these different character traits in everybody.
Were you kind of doubtful at the time that any of them applied to you? Did you like?
No, I knew they all applied to me.
Okay.
Because I knew I was. I'd already given up,
mm-hmm.
and when I had given up, I mean, I had been through 10 different rehabs. 3 times I had over a year sober, but you know, you get overwhelmed and life hits you. You know.
Yeah.
And when life hits you like that, boy, you know, if you're in a snowball fight, you can take one snowball to the face, and then you can take two, boom, boom, and then you probably could take three, boom, boom, boom. But then you start getting hit with 6 or 7 and stuff like that, and then you get knocked down and you start getting overwhelmed. So what do? You run for a crutch.
At that point in prison, and when you started to change, were you writing poetry then? Because you have a beautiful song called Salvation, which is on YouTube and is available for sale as well, and we'll go into all of that. Did you always express yourself in like as a poet or as a songwriter, or did that come later?
Well, when I was in school and everything, in high school and stuff, I loved Alabama, the music group Alabama, and yeah. I liked Hank Williams Jr. and Willie Nelson and all these guys, and I sang the songs and everything, and you know, I didn't think I was half bad.
Hey, you've got a good voice, gosh, man. You've got a damn good voice. Like, very impressive.
Thank you. Thank you. But my girlfriend at the time, I had written a song for her, and called Bright Eyes. I don't remember the words or anything, but she still got that song. I've heard her mom has told me.
Uh-huh.
Her mom's like 70 now, so, you know. But yeah, she says she still got it. She and still listens to it. Well, I wrote that a long time ago. Well, then I started wrestling, and I followed that dream because that's what I wanted to be.
Yeah.
And then while I was on the road, well, I got the opportunity to do Waking Up Alone on Vince's on the Pile Driver album. I recorded it, but Hillbilly Jim had a deal with CBS Records, so they didn't want him taking that, so they let Hillbilly Jim record Waking Up Alone for the album.
Wow, I didn't know that. Okay.
I kind of got, that was the first time we're messing you around.
Yes.
You know, oh, dolls. Yes. Dolls. Oh, okay. There's a, you know, oh, they're action figures. I'm sorry.
So, anyway. Yeah, I do collect them. So they are action figures. They're not dolls.
Yeah. I always call them dolls just to tick people off. Oh, look. Hey, look.
My friend does that.
Look,
yeah.
yeah, look at the Bill Eadie doll. It's an action figure. You know, that's when you get told by Bill Eadie it's an action figure. You know, it's an action figure then.
So anyway, how far along the line did the Sam Houston action figure get? Was it? I'm guessing.
I don't know. They made action figures of my likeness and everything, but they didn't put my name on them.
Yeah.
But it's got my hair and my mullet, my boots, you know, my stuff. But it's not me. Anyway. Where were we at before I got off on the action figure?
We were...
You'd ask a music. Question and I started squirreling off.
We were talking music.
Oh, music, that's right. Okay, so Hillbilly Jim did the Waking Up Alone thing, and then I didn't get a chance to. So I was in the Carolinas, and I was, you know, I was very strong in the Carolinas as far as my fan base and everything.
Yeah.
Because I'd been with Crockett down there for years. And, I mean, I was on a Hooters highlight reel. I'm sitting here wondering why everybody in Hooters is staring at me watching the sandwich while I'm eating the sandwich.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden they say, oh, the TV was above my head. I'm on TV. You know, it's like, oh, wow. I didn't even know.
Uh-huh.
You know, but anyway, about that time I got to go. But that was about the time I got to drive the race car, the NASCAR around the track in Charlotte too, one time. Take it around once. Okay. Bring it in now. Because I was, oh! Anyway. So with the music, that was the first thing. Well, I put a band together. I met a fella up in Concord, North Carolina. He just passed. His name was Willie Clay. He was a bass player, and he played a couple other things. Well, he turned me on to the best guitar player that I've probably ever seen, a guy by the name of Johnny Whittington.
Mm-hmm.
And then Virgil McClellan, and we became Sam Houston and the Young Guns from, you know, because the movie was popular. Young Guns 2 had just come out.
Yeah.
Or something around there. So we were doing shows in the Carolinas, and I was writing my own music. I'd written a song for Nicklet called Poetry in Motion. And I had gone, worked on my songs for a while. And finally in the 90s, in the mid 90s, I was able to get in a recording studio and record them. And I had them, but at the time I was such a drunk, I couldn't do anything with them.
Hmm.
You know? So I had the tapes, and then, I guess, you know, life picks you up and carries you off. And that's what it did to me. I lost me and my addiction. Any moving forward is not going to happen when there's an alcohol bottle right next to me.
Yeah.
I'm just going to sit right here and drink, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what it was. And then I lost the master tapes in Katrina. So now all hope is lost. But the lady, Chris Seitz, a friend of mine from St. Louis, I had met years ago, in Nashville, she had lost a loved one on Christmas at a Christmas party. He was her husband was shot by a family member in front of everybody at a Christmas party.
Wow.
And I helped her deal with the trauma, the loss, and everything. So at that time I got her interested in writing music too, and that was what she used to, I guess. Kind of like help counsel or kind of help herself.
Yeah, I get
that. She would write music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we were close that way. We saw each other a couple of times. You know, I was all over the country and stuff. So she had one of my cassette tapes. And we had lost contact after Katrina, Hurricane Katrina and everything, and didn't know how to couldn't reach each other, this or that. And finally she found me in August.
Mm-hmm.
So we started talking, and when I started helping this lady, Teresa Massey, she's an amputee, or when I rescued her for WrestleMania, she had one leg at the time. Now she's a double amputee. I saw her Thanksgiving Day, but last November. And I took her to her house, and when I took her to her house, she had no ramp. She lives alone. Her house is 9 feet off the ground, and she's got no ramp. Somebody's got to be there to help get her down. So
yeah,
I got together with Chris and started the Sam Houston God's Got a Hold on Me page. And we've done a whole lot.
Yeah, you've done some amazing things with it, and I was, Teresa from speaking to her as well. She, considering everything that she's been through, she has such a positive attitude to everything, and she's been a pleasure to talk to as well. And I'm really glad that she's been able to get everything that she needs, considering everything that she's been through as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and Chris is a super lady, you know, and she's real good about staying on top, you know, calling me, because I forget, man, I've been hitting the head with a lot of chairs throughout my career.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of them. So I forget, and I, you know, like, and I'll squirrel off and this way or that way. Oh, you got to do this tomorrow, or you got to do, okay, yeah, the boom. But she's been really helping me out with the schedule. So I'm really looking forward to, I just got the little thumb drives from Florida where I filmed The Miracle in Motion, which is I've been paralyzed twice. My father had muscular dystrophy, a form of muscular dystrophy. It's a workout program.
Yeah.
And the lady, when I moved to Florida to go over there for Dave Nelson, and then got like left high and dry, I moved in with a lady and she was disabled. She had broken back or broken spinal column. Her name was is Sharif Perez. You know, she works out now every day.
Wow.
And she can put braces on and walk.
That's amazing.
That lady may never walk without the braces again, but you know, she could, when I first got there, she wasn't doing that.
It is one of those things that, like, you don't realize what resolve and strength that you have until you really do hit rock bottom, you know, in terms of,
And my brother, let me tell you something. I was in rock bottom on Florida. I was on my face in the living room praying and looking for a way to stay comfortable down there, because I knew that I was not good enough for my maker. You know, we don't deserve to be in his glory. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm coming to you from a very spiritual level. And then in deep in prayer, he told me to rise, you know, and when he told me to rise, you know, I'm not going to ever be second best.
Yeah.
My Lord gives this to me every day. And I'm going to go out there and share it with everybody I can. If I can motivate you, I want to motivate you. If I can help you, then I can help you. If you've got a battle on your hands and you can't get through it, well, hang on. I'll catch up to you and help pick you up, and we'll go together.
And it certainly, because, you know, my connection to you has been through Facebook, but just through social media, you can see everything that you've done and what a good guy you are, and you know, considering everything that you've been through as well, that you not only have helped yourself, but it's kind of you've had to help yourself to be able to help others, sort of thing.
Well, yeah, you know, okay, here's the way. I'm not gonna stand there and tell you what to do.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna tell you how to live your life. Now, if you see what's going on in mine, and if you ask, I'll be glad to help show you. I'll be glad to direct you. I'll be glad, you know. But I lead by example.
Yeah.
You know, if you like what I'm doing, join in. You know. If you don't, get out of my way, because I'll knock you over.
Well, do you feel that you have, because it certainly seems this way, that you have never been involved in as many projects at the same time, sort of thing, in some ways that you've never been busier, but that is like such a good thing to keep you motivated and keep you going, because, you know, you're releasing music videos, you know, you're starting your own company, you're still wrestling as well, and you're doing all these projects. So, you know, even though you are a little older, that, you know, your life has never been busier, and you just never been more active doing really good things. Like,
that was... Well, you know, okay, if I was still drinking,
yeah.
Oh yeah, none of this would be happening.
Yeah.
You know? But these are dreams I have, you know, and it's kind of like, I'd get in the ring. every once in a while, I'd get in the ring down at WXW for Alpha. You know, The Rock's uncle has, he's got a school in Mineola.
Yeah.
So when I got down to Florida, I started going over to a school. And one of the things I wanted these guys to understand is they have an opportunity today, right now, to put their boots on and get in the ring and reach for their dreams.
Yeah.
Okay, you're getting this opportunity to get in this ring and be everything you ever wanted to be. If it really means that much, if there's really that desire in your heart, then you're going to go through, you'll go through a bed of nails. You'll do whatever you've got to do to get there. You'll crawl through broken glass. You know, it's those people that want to sit back and just wait it out and let something happen and be given to them. If it's your dream, if you don't pursue it, if you don't follow it, when you don't make it, who can you blame? No one.
Yeah.
You know, I had a buddy of mine. Oh, gosh. He was a 17-year-old kid when I first met him. He was going to a training school with another fella down in Alexandria, Louisiana. So he was training with him. Well, I got in the ring and I worked out with him a few times. Well, the guy had potential. Kid had potential, you know. So when the time was right and I thought he had kept himself in shape, I got him a tryout for Vince. You know, and so we go to Baton Rouge, and he's got his tryout and everything. And I don't know if he'd taken pills or what he had done before he got out there, but he definitely was not on his A game.
Then we're in the dressing room after,
and I was talking, and John Laurinaitis comes through, and there was a fellow that had also had a tryout that I had worked with the month before. And he goes up to John, and he says, look, he goes, I'm sorry about my match out there, this, that, and the other. And he's making excuses. He said, I'm sorry about my match. He said, but you can ask anybody. I worked with Sam last month, and we had the best match on the card, and John Laurinaitis stopped him.
Yeah.
This was in 2007 in Baton Rouge at the River Center. And he said, anyone, that works with Sam Houston is going to have the best match on the card that night.
Wow. See, it didn't
get, you know, that made me feel good, you know, and then I got to turn around to my buddy and cause he, you know, I said, hey, you know, you really made me, you know, cause it did, you know, he wasn't on his A game. I'd done everything I could. It was his dream to be a wrestler. Now he's never accomplished any of that. Now he's bitter against the business. It wasn't the business's fault.
Yeah.
It was his fault for not going after his dreams.
I think that, you know, because I was going to ask whether him being bad in the ring would have unintentionally made you look bad as someone who recommended him, but obviously it wasn't that way, and they totally
no, because the very next time I went, I took him. I found this one fella, and he was 7 foot tall, and I took him down there, and he signed on. They signed him to a contract. Mm-hmm. He weighed 460 pounds, but when they get him into the training center, you know, they want to see if you're going to do, you know, follow their rules.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to test their limits. It's pushing the envelope. So this guy knew what he was. He knew he was 7 foot tall. He knew he was agile. He knew he was athletic. You know, he knew he could move. And he knew he was money in the bank.
Yeah.
You know, I saw that when him and Big Show were standing there looking at each other eye to eye when Vince walked up. You know, and they signed my buddy to a deal. And he stuck with it a few weeks, but then they came and told him they wanted him to lose 30 pounds and trying to put him through some rough regimen that would have probably killed, you know, a guy that big. You got to take care of your joints and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You absolutely. Know, they don't need to train the same way a smaller guy would. You know, you've got to get stretched. You've got to get movement in those muscles. You can't, like, just do short, squatty things.
Yeah.
You know, you draw all up.
Well, it seems that, like, one thing that wrestlers have now that your generation may not have had was the benefit of your generation's experience, because I'd imagine that the generation before you weren't quite as open about things. But your generation as well, in the 70s and 80s, with the excess of the drugs and everything as well, you have so many more life lessons that you can give to the current generation. And do you feel that sometimes they don't listen because
they... Oh, yeah, no, they don't. Okay. No, they don't.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, gosh. I've been there. Yeah, I've done it all. I've wrestled at the world's biggest party. I opened up for the Who, Pete Townsend and the Who twice. I've almost been eaten by cannibals twice. Yeah. I've done it all. I've climbed mountains. I've swam in five different oceans. You know, so I've been everywhere, done just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when I try to go to, oh, well, they've done this or they've done that. Well, you haven't done much. And if you're not going to listen, you're not going to be able to get helped. Now, back in the older generation, yeah, they were very kayfabe. They were very hush hush. You didn't share your lives like what you do nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, everybody was a family man back then, or, you know, had their deal, and, you know, they show up to the matches, do their job, and leave. Nowadays, it's, you know, gosh, everybody's all roped in together because of travel and everything. But they kayfabed each other back then. Now we're letting everything fly, this generation of guys now. And that's why I want to be able to, I'll talk about anything with anybody.
Mm.
Because they can't get help unless they know, you know, and you're not going to get it. That's when my preacher come to me the other day. I'd let him look. He's got a degree in substance abuse, addictions and stuff, but he's never had an addiction.
Oh, really? You know,
wow. He's never been addicted
but to substance it.
Like that.
Yeah.
So I turned over some of my workbooks that helped me. And it had a lot of personal things in it. And he said, are you sure? He said, this is your personal stuff. And I said, I can't help the next guy unless he understands where I've been.
Yeah. Well, go for it.
Sorry. Everywhere I've been is kind of an open book.
Well, I really...
You know, and I don't have anything to hide, you know? It's not like I got a great big suitcase full of money I'm trying to keep away from everybody or nothing.
Well,
if anybody does find that suitcase, please return it because I lost it in luggage a while back.
Yeah, I was going to say that's what you're telling everyone, but you know, it's kayfabe. You really got millions just stashed away. You know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, which I quit. I started working on the second million. They said that first million is too hard to get, so I gave up on that a long time ago.
Yeah,
I'm working on the second one now.
Well, I really want to thank you for, you know, because you don't know me, you know, and you had enough trust in me to, you know, let me interview you, and hopefully, I try not to dig too deeply into sort of personal lives.
My brother, let me go ahead and tell you something. Okay. I have thoroughly enjoyed doing this interview with you, and I mean that.
Thank you.
Any time that you would like to discuss anything, and I'm telling you right now, you can take the gloves off. You can ask me about anything. There are some things that I can't answer on, like, you know, both my brother and my father have come out. My brother and my sister have come out and said that they were, mistreated and this, that, and the other. I wasn't molested. I wasn't mistreated like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I was used as bait, mm-hmm. really. I didn't find out from that till I was about 28 years old. And Ron Bass told me in the dressing room, he said, you just didn't know. Well, I know both my brother and my sister had issues with my father. And then the time I was in the program in prison, I had to go and have a lot of counseling about that as well. Not that I was ever sexually molested or physically, or I mean, I got knocked around some, but I wasn't, you know, abused.
Yeah.
Just, you know. just got kind of uppity and had to get taken down a peg, probably. well, But things like that, I can't answer for other people. I can answer for myself, and I'm more than willing to do that to help other people. You can take the gloves off. You can ask me anything you want to, and I'll give you an honest answer. How's that?
That sounds amazing. I really appreciative, because you know this podcast is something that I've been doing for 2 years now, and I've been lucky enough to interview people in all fields of entertainment as well, and I'm always honored that someone would want to spend some time to be able to chat with me, and I am a fan, and it's just an honor to be able to make contact, really. Well, cool. Especially being from the UK as well, because we're thousands of miles away, and
Well, you ought to get me out there for a concert. Why don't you play my song here in a minute?
Yes, I will.
Let everybody hear it. And let everybody hear it. And then maybe some promoter that wants to make some money off a country music guy and a professional wrestler, although I am a handful.
I don't think you can be a country music guy and not be a handful, to be fair. I've got friends who are huge into country, and they're some of the wildest people I've ever met. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got to tell you, you remember Johnny Lee? He sang Looking for Love in the Urban Cowboy movie. This was way back in the early 80s. Anyway, he was playing in Minnesota, and we were all at the concert, a bunch of wrestlers, Kurt Hennig, this one, that one, the other. And I guess his band and him, they started, saying they were partying with wrestlers, and would they drink us under the table, and oh, gosh, that's when you start hearing pill bottles start shaking. And I heard that Johnny Lee fell asleep during the second song he was singing on stage, and they had to refund everybody's money.
Oh.
So we're at Hamble.
That's impressive. I would hope he's at least sitting down while he's performing. He didn't just fall asleep, stood up.
I don't know. I've seen Greg Valentine fall asleep standing in the corner in Seattle. Him and Honky Tonk Man, they were wrestling the British Bulldogs.
Oh.
And so it was billed as, I forgot. But in the dressing room, because at the time, Honky Tonk Man looked like Elvis and Greg Valentine looked like Roy Orbison.
Yeah.
So back their nickname in the dressing room was the Dead Rock and Roll Express. So one night when we got, it was a double show or something. And when we got to Seattle for the second event for that day, somebody had dumped a box of Halcyon's sleeping pills in the coffee.
Oh.
And Greg Valentine was drinking coffee, trying to stay awake. When he got out in the ring, Honky Tonk was in the ring getting bumped all over the place, and Greg fell asleep standing in the corner.
in Seattle as well. That's his hometown. So, there's no bad place to,
check this one out. You'll love this one. Okay, may have told you this. Ultimate Warrior and I were pretty tight.
Yeah.
We traveled together for 2 years before they let Jim on TV.
Yeah.
They would film him, but only to go back to the office and look and see how he was progressing.
Yeah.
See, I was helping him out with his ring work, and he was helping me out in the gym.
Mm.
So, anyway, one night in El Paso, I'd been running my mouth, I guess, or something, and he'd come back. I'd wrestled 20 minutes with Danny Davis, and I'd come back from the ring, and they were having the bunkhouse battle royals.
Right.
And I didn't have time. I had to just turn back around and go back out to the ring. So I get to the dressing room. I grab me a drink of water. Well, when I do, Hellwig's over me, Ultimate Warrior, and he's hosing me down with baby oil. And I don't like baby oil. I said, what are you doing? And he said, Sam, they're going to get you. He goes, all of them been talking about that. He goes, they're going to get you. There's money on your head to see who can get you. So I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, now I'm all oiled up. So I go out to the ring, and I tell you what, it was a grease pig and a rodeo. They were every time somebody snatched me, I was snaking out. And boy, when I got back in the dressing room, I laughed in everybody's face. All them big boys. And I told them, too. Well, anyway, 2 nights later in Wichita Falls, same thing. And I come back from the ring. And we've got to turn back around and go out for the deal. Well, Ultimate Warrior, again, he's got the baby oil, and he's hosing me down. Well, Mr. Fuji was sitting back in the back and saw who was doing what and helping me out against all his other guys. So in the ring, and all them guys come after me again. I'm shooting all over the place, you know, just slipping around them, getting away from them and stuff, and laughing the whole time. Mr. Fuji got up on his knees behind Hellwig, behind Ultimate Warrior on the apron, and tied those strings to his arms to the top rope.
Oh. Yep, you can't outrib Fuji, I think. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was about 10 minutes after the match was over. But well, it was when the ring crew started tearing down the ring is when they finally untied him. You know, all he could do is sit there and, you know, run his arms back and forth, you know, shake the top rope.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. So I've got all kind of fun with Van. But anytime you want to call, we can talk about funny stories, because we can talk about ribs I've pulled. We can talk about whatever you want to do, my brother.
That sounds great. I do have a couple of, you know, because I, again, growing up, we specifically got WWF in the UK. And the first time I ever saw you was the WrestleMania 4 Battle Royal. And I'm guessing, I mean, it could be a coincidence, but obviously you go, from what you've told me, you go way back with the Samoans, and Seeker eliminated you from that Battle Royal. Would that have been a thing that was discussed, that you wanted Seeker to eliminate you, or?
Oh, I think I went up to him, because I think I took like a backdrop or some kind of big flying thing over the top and cut a flip in the air and all kind of stuff. I don't remember.
That was going to say, with those events, because you were on, you know, you were at the Royal Rumble, you were at WrestleMania, you were at Survivor Series, you won big events like Saturday Night's Main Event, etc. Did they feel bigger than usual, or were they just another night at the office sort of thing?
Well, I mean, you knew it was pay-per-view, you knew it was bigger because, you know, and you had the butterflies in your stomach and everything. But once you first got out there, and once that initial pop is over with and everything,
yeah,
and the bell rings and you can finally sit there, yeah, you still are a little bit more apprehensive and you're still a little bit more gung-ho. But, you know, a good guy can calm himself down.
Mm-hmm. When you were, this is a question from a listener, Grant. He asks about Survivor Series 88, where you teamed up with The Warrior, Owen Hart, Scott Casey, and Beefcake, I think.
When you said that, when you say this, let me tell you this. Okay, when I walked in from that match, I remember the match.
Yeah.
I walked in from that match. Vince McMahon met me right there at the gorilla position and shook my hand. And he said, nobody else knows this. He said, but you did. He said, you got everybody over out there. I was the only one that sold anything, if you watch that match.
Yeah.
I got everybody over. I got the match over.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of weird as well. You may not know this, but because it was the first match of the night. But when the VHS came out, I think it was moved to like maybe the second or third match. I don't know why. It was just because of, maybe it made the show flow better or something like that. But you were in the ring with...
Probably.
You were in the ring with, like, all these top names. Did you feel that at that point, because you had been there for a while at that point, did you feel that the push was coming, or did you feel that the position that you were in, you weren't really going to break through that glass ceiling kind of thing?
Well, okay. You always hope for the best.
Yeah.
And you always, you know, you're always praying for, you know, to be seen or this, that, or the other. But when you get to right down to it, you know, the brass tacks of it is, you know, I was there to do a job and I did my job the best of my ability.
Yeah.
I put, you know, and here's, okay. This is how it was explained to me when I first broke in the business. And Johnny Weaver was the one that did it. You know, he said, if I go out there and you go out there, and we both go out there and we just try to get ourselves over, he said, we're both going to bust our ass and we're both going to fall on our ass.
Yeah.
And nothing's going to happen. Nobody's going to remember the match.
Yeah.
He said, if we both go out there to just get me over, he said, I'll get over. He said, if we both go out there to get just you over, you'll get over.
Hmm.
He said, but if we go out there and get the match over, the match gets over, we both get over. Win, lose, or draw, we both get over.
Did you
in the people's eyes?
Did you feel, because I didn't know that you were there for so long until 91. Because like for whatever reason, you by that time you weren't on TV too much. was it just more about having fun in front of the arena, in front of the crowd?
Well, what it was, what, okay, if they beat, okay, they hadn't started, you know, there wasn't a clear, I guess there was a clear winner, loser, blah, blah, blah. You know, oh, I could tell who's going to lose. Okay. Yeah. I tried to not to, you know, give, I tried to always go out there and give it my best and make it look like a competition.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if the office liked that or not. Several times, guys were told not to sell, you know, but then several times they ended up having to anyway. You know, a boss man was told not to go off his feet wrestling me.
The boss man was, from my point of view, again, from watching him against, like, you or Coco Beware or whatever, he was very generous in terms of...
Yes.
Yeah. And it made...
Well, go back after we're done with this. Go back and watch mine and boss man. Just watch one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I put a lot of effort, a lot of thought, you know, into those, you know.
I'm almost certain that I saw you, it was an LA Sports Arena show, very early boss man against you. I could be wrong, but I'm sure I've seen a match with you and him, and I'm hoping there is stuff on YouTube still, and WWE haven't taken it down.
It's not on YouTube, it's on Daily Motion.
Oh, okay.
You have to go to Daily Motion. I think they still have two of the matches.
Okay, I will post the links and Vince can sue me if he wants. But I've had
there you go. No, he don't need to sue over something, you know, that emulates his business.
Yes.
That shines, you know, and he needs to be proud of what his boys could do.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
You know, and he needs to give some of the glory to where it needs to go to.
Yeah, I agree with you that. Know? Did you feel that? A lot of the heels from that time as well, because there was no merchandise for the heels, and they quite rightly thought that you know, it takes a heel to make the match as well. It takes two, so they felt that the royalties weren't evenly spread out, to say the least.
No, but see, the royalties were so, that was so messed up anyway. By the time it's all said and done, you're only getting 0.001% of whatever you sell.
Yeah.
So you got to sell 35 t-shirts to make a dollar.
Okay.
You know, and everything has to be licensed through Vince.
Hmm.
You know, the merchandising, oh gosh, that's a whole nother ball of wax.
Yeah, I couldn't even begin to.
Because Vince creates the merchandise, and then because he owns the companies that makes the merchandise, he can charge himself whatever he wants to, and then he has to charge himself that licensing fee.
Yeah.
So if you want any of our stars, you have to buy it through the licensing fee of the WWE, and when you do it like that, then that Steve Austin or The Rock or whoever's got that T-shirt out, they're going to get 0.001 or point this, that, or the other percent.
Hmm. Just a few more questions and I will let you go, but did Vince, in particular, out of all the companies that you work for, did he try and put his own stamp on Sam Houston?
No.
Okay.
No. He liked the dance, but I was already doing the dance.
Yeah. Who taught you that?
I was doing it. Huh?
Who taught you that? David, another listener, wanted to know who taught you that dance as well.
Oh, I just learned it in a drunken stupor one night at the honky-tonk.
Uh-huh. It's great.
You know, you had everybody out there doing the line dances and everything, you know, and they're all dancing together. You know, there's 80 people on the dance floor doing this dance. Well, I can't do that dance, but I can do this one, by God, and I can kick you out of the way when I do it. But here's something really neat. You know, I did that Texas two-step on TV one night in Iowa. I believe it was Iowa or Illinois.
Yeah.
We were driving through, Ron Simmons and myself. We stopped to get beer at a Red Stallion, a bar, because you couldn't buy beer. You had to go to a package store or buy it out of a bar. So we bought it in a bar, and there were two tour buses there.
Mm-hmm.
And then this what appeared to be a woman, we found out it wasn't, but what appeared to be a woman come up and asked me, and she goes, "Are you Sam Houston?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "My boss would like to meet you." I said, "Who's your boss?" She said, "Trisha Yearwood." Oh, I got to tell you, I ran right over there. I talked with Miss Yearwood. I talked to her for a little while. And yes, we did get up in two-step.
That's amazing.
And Ron Simmons can verify that.
With your time in WWF, because there were so many unique characters, but there were also other cowboys there, like Ron Bass and Scott Casey was doing the cowboy thing. Was there ever a conflict of interest with the characters?
No, not really. Just one time, and I feel bad for even doing it now, but I worked really hard on trying to change the bulldog around to something that fit me, and it's a flying bulldog. Mm-hmm. And I think my bulldog is still way far better than any other guys doing it now.
Yeah.
You know, because I catch you like you jumping off a horse. Scott Casey did it one night on TV, and I asked him not to use my finish on TV.
And I'm guessing that was fine. Like,
yeah. I mean, there was no problems with it or anything like that. It's like, hey, dude, that's my finish.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like Jake. You know, you'd want to go up to somebody and say, hey, man, that's my finish. You're using it as a high spot, or you're using it as this, that, and the other. I beat people with that.
Everyone kicks out of the DDT now.
It's just you're just trying to look out for the moves. You know, like nowadays, a guy will take 35 suplexes and still kick out.
Yeah.
You know? But back in 1972, Dick Murdoch pick you up for a brainbuster, drop you on your head, and it's done.
Yeah. And the brainbuster,
people are wasting things. You know, when you kick out of a pal driver,
Yeah.
And everybody does. And you kick out of it three times in one match.
I'll not go too much into it, but it almost seems like attention deficit disorder TV now, where you're not expected to remember what happened a week ago. That doesn't matter that you kicked out of five pile drivers or whatever.
Vince McMahon, and I hate to say it like this, but Vince McMahon, I believe they truly believe that they can program people into whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now, okay, do you remember when the New Day came out?
Yeah.
Oh, man, everybody hating them, right? Now he's turned them into something, kept them around for so long, finally turned them into something. That's like Daniel Bryan. Finally, they found the yes thing.
Yeah.
You know, because before then, they couldn't figure out what to do with him. They were stuck with him.
Yeah.
And, he had no charisma, and then finally they just kept on and kept on and kept on. So Vince McMahon thinks, okay, now it's got to the point where after a couple of weeks, whatever we did a couple of weeks ago is dead. But it used to be, a year later, and then it switched to like 3 months later, take a relief and come back 3 months or 6 months later.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, just a couple more questions.
Like Jinder Mahal. I mean, I read something on him the other day. I said he never won a match until Vince McMahon or till the WWE figured out how many people there were in India, and then the next thing you know, he turned around, he's the champion.
Yeah, and it's certainly not the first time that they've catered to an audience that they're trying to sort of get maybe a TV deal for or whatever, and I understand it to a point, but it just doesn't translate to like every audience, and I guess you can't please everyone anyway, but not a lot means anything anymore, put it that way.
It's back to that other thing. Oh, you got to remember, it's pro wrestling. Don't give it any legitimacy. That's what's different between me and all the other guys. I know the business is a work, and I know this, that, and the other about it and everything else, but still, the wrestling business to me is a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
The wrestling and everything that happens to me when I'm in the ring is real.
Yeah.
It just depends on the degree of pain I'm in, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But everything that happens to me in the ring is real. And so every emotion that I'm feeding out to the people or to the fans, that's all me. That's all real.
Yeah.
No, what I get back from them, here's the beautiful part. What I get back from them is all real too.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. That's
They're in that fight with me.
Yeah, it has to start with you as well. If you don't believe what you're selling, then no one else is going to believe it, sort of thing.
Right, and I do.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You know, and it's like I tell, and I can't wait to tell these the guys in Vegas again. Mm. I'm going to have a seminar there. I've heard, so I want to go out there and educate and help these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they don't know how they've never worked an opportunity. They've never had the opportunity to be on the road every day.
Yeah.
You know. Their stuff is like, you know, every other weekend.
Well,
I mean, some guys get lucky and they're working every weekend.
Yeah. It's something that Bobby Heenan said as well, that until you've had to feed yourself from wrestling, you know, you'd never really put 100% into it, sort of thing, because you've never really had to.
Right.
You know, and that's when you have to really come up with something either unique or something that, you know, you keep going until you find something that connects with an audience. And, you know, yeah, it was just something I remember Bobby Heenan saying, that, you know, you're not really a pro until you've had to feed yourself from
until
it.
Until you depend on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, in the wrestling business, I'm 54 years old, my man. The wrestling business was there when I was born. And I pray to God the wrestling business will still be there the day I die.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. And you will, I think you belong in just about any Hall of Fame, you know, because you have the respect from all of your peers and you were incredibly popular with fans. And it just, you know, I think that's what matters. You know, before championships and stuff like that, that's kind of superficial. But, you know, the fact that you had the fans every night, you know, jumping and screaming.
And see, I was in that one. I was in that, oh gosh, that small percentage of guys that could go out there after Hulk Hogan went on the third match.
Yeah.
On a 7-match card. I was one of those guys that could go out there after Hogan and be in the fourth match and get the people back up. Get the people back into it. Because they'd already seen what they came to, what they paid to see.
Yeah.
You know, and they got all their glory. They got the pose down. They got the whole nine yards. And, you know, they were spent after seeing Hogan and giving Hogan everything.
Yeah.
But then you got somebody like me going out there with Bret Hart or with Curt Hennig or somebody like that, and going out there and getting the people back on their feet.
100%. And you see it on actual cards that were televised and everything as well. And I've seen some cards where Hogan's been on halfway through and then it's just died to death. But that depends on who you put on after Hogan as well. And, you know,
that's right. You're exactly right.
So,
my man, it's been, go ahead.
Oh, no, well, just one more question, actually two more questions, sure. But then I want to talk about this one more time about the show and your track Salvation as well. But what did you think of your entrance music? Did that start to get on your nerves after a little while?
Well, you know, it was kind of like, no, not really. I mean, because the first couple of times you're all excited.
Yeah.
Because it's your entrance music. And then it's kind of like, oh, this is all they did with it, you know? Okay, well, you know, try to make the most of it.
It was kind of
try to get what I can out of it.
Yeah, it was kind of now like a program.
Now when I hear it, it's kind of like, now when I hear it, it's kind of like I look at people and go, really? Okay, you know?
It was like some weird programmed banjo. I don't think it was even real banjo. It was kind of weird, but
no, probably not.
When Rockin' Robin used it as well, was that kind of an insider thing, or was that just... like, was that just as kind of a, not a rib, but like kind of a tribute to the family, I guess? Or...
Oh, I don't know. I think they were just short of music and they just said, "Use Sam."
Okay.
She looks like him anyway. Yeah.
She
had the mullet too.
I saw a recent picture of you at, I don't think it was WrestleCon, but I saw you and Jake together and it was a great picture. So is everything... Do you see each other a lot, and how's the relationship?
Well, we don't see each other a lot, you know, but we do see each other, and when we do see each other, we have a nice time.
Yeah.
You know, and it's cool. I mean, Jake and there was a couple of times in our lives that we were around each other a lot, and we're close and stuff like that. Now it's kind of like, well, I'll see you when I see you, you know. I reach out, but, you know, he's busy too, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just hard now. I will get to see him. I'll be going to Vegas, so I intend to go to the school out there and everything and maybe work out with some of them guys.
Yeah.
Over to school. And if I don't get to do that, well, at least I'm going to grab his Jake the Snake action figure again. I'm going to put it in the middle of the ring again. And I'm going to have somebody film it again. And then I'm going to drop another elbow on it again.
Oh, that's heat.
Yeah. And then I'm going to pin it.
Well,
for a five count, yeah.
Oh, five. Got to be a five
count. King Kong Bundy, five count.
Well, Sam, thank you for doing this, and I don't want to hold you up anymore. This is going to be a two-parter because we went so long. We went 2 hour Broadway, I think, and you know, I'm going to tap out.
That's awesome. All right, my brother.
But yes, well, everyone please, should go. Yeah. Go for it. Sorry.
Oh yeah, I just want everybody to know May 5th. Is the debut for the All Pro Wrestling League in Whitesboro, Texas. It's going to be 6 big matches featuring Jazz from WWE, formerly of WWE. She was a ladies champion.
Oh, yeah.
Kay Kramer Downs, our ladies match. Rugged Rod Price has expressed a desire to step foot in the ring with some of these boys. I told him about these guys and their lack of respect. So he's actually said if he'll bring his boots. But we've got 6 big matches. I'm wrestling Kojak Sly. Now he's one of the stars with Wildcat Sports, which is I guess one of the farm leagues for Vince McMahon. I'm very impressed with those guys with the Wildcat Sports. I'm very impressed with the WXW. I'm impressed with a few of the schools that I've been around and seen. And I'm only going to use the elite. I'm only going to use the best that I can get. So keep your eyes and ears open because Sam Houston's kicking down the door and when I kick through it, I'm coming full steam. Nice. You know, I want you to listen to my song. My hope, my prayer is that it gives you encouragement. It gives you strength. And I'm going to tell you something. As long as you've got something to hope for in your life, you got a reason to fight. You got a reason to keep moving forward. So please, my friends, keep moving forward. I love you all. God bless. And you have a great time. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Goodbye.
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 Goodbye.